Chapter 9. Confused, perhaps, by the anticipation of the meeting, paused a moment, as if in doubt, before the small oddly clad figure which blocked her path a horrible moment to Garnet, who felt a pang of misery at this satire on the infallibility of the filial instinct. He longed to make some sign, to break in some way the pause of uncertainty. But before he could move he saw Mrs. Newell give her daughter a sharp push, he saw a blush of compunction flood Hermione's face, and the girl, throwing back her veil, bent her tall head, and flung her arms about her father. Mr. Newell emerged unshaken from the embrace. It seemed to have no effect beyond giving an odder twist to his tie. He stood beside his daughter till the church doors were thrown open. Then, at a sign from the verger, he gave her his arm, and the strange couple, with the long train of fashion and finery behind them, started on their march to the altar. Garnet had already slipped into the church, and secured a post of vantage which gave him a side view over the assemblage. The building was thronged. Mrs. Newell had attained her ambition, and given Hermione a smart wedding. Garnet's eye traveled curiously from one group to another from the numerous representatives of the bridegroom's family, all stamped with the same air of somewhat doughty distinction, the air of having had their thinking done for them for so long that they could no longer perform the act individually, and the heterogeneous company of Mrs. Newell's friends, who presented, on the opposite side of the nave, every variety of individual conviction in dress and conduct. Of the two groups the latter was decidedly the more interesting to Garnet, who observed that it comprised, not only such recent acquisitions as the Woolsey Hubbards and the Baron, but also sundry more important figures which of late had faded to the verse of Mrs. Newell's horizon. Hermione's marriage had drawn them back, had once more made her mother a social entity, had in short already accomplished the object for which it had been planned and executed. And as he looked about him Garnet saw that all the other actors in the show faded into insignificance beside the dominant figure of Mrs. Newell, became mere marionettes pulled hither and thither by the hidden wires of her intention. One and all they were there to serve her ends, and accomplish her purpose. Schenkeldorf and the Hubbards, to pay for the show, the bride and bridegroom to seal and symbolize her social rehabilitation, Garnet himself as the humble instrument adjusting the different parts of the complicated machinery, and her husband, finally, as the last stake in her game, the last asset on which she could draw to rebuild her fallen fortunes. At the thought Garnet was filled with a deep disgust for what the scene signified, and for his own share in it. He had been her tool and dupe like the others. If he imagined that he was serving Hermione, it was for her mother's ends that he had worked. What right had he to sentimentalize a marriage founded on such base connivances, and how could he have imagined that in so doing he was acting a disinterested part? While these thoughts were passing through his mind the ceremony had already begun, and the principal personages in the drama were ranged before him in the row of crimson velvet chairs which fills the foreground of a Catholic marriage. Through the glow of lights and the perfumed haze about the altar, Garnet's eyes rested on the central figures of the group, and gradually the others disappeared from his view and his mind. After all, neither Mrs. Newell's schmess nor his own share in them could ever unsanctify Hermione's marriage. It was one more testimony to life's indefatigable renewals, to nature's secret of drawing fragrance from corruption. And as his eyes turned from the girl's illuminated presence to the resigned and stoical figure sunk in the adjoining chair, it occurred to him that he had perhaps worked better than he knew in placing them, if only for a moment, side by side. And trust? In the good days, just after we all left college, Ned Hallidon and I used to listen, laughing and smoking, while Paul Ambrose set forth his plans. They were immense, these plans, involving, as it sometimes seemed, the ultimate aesthetic redemption of the whole human race, and provisionally restoring the sense of beauty to those unhappy millions of our fellow countrymen who, as Ambrose movingly pointed out, now live and die in surroundings of unperceived and unmitigated ugliness. I want to bring the poor starved wretches back to their lost inheritance, to the divine past they've thrown away. I want to make them hate ugliness, so that they'll smash nearly everything in sight, he would passionately exclaim, stretching his arms across the shabby black walnut writing table, and shaking his thin consumptive fist in the fact of all the accumulated ugliness in the world. You might set the example by smashing that table, I once suggested with youthful brutality. And Paul, pulling himself up, cast a surprised glance at me, and then looked slowly about the parental library in which we sat. His parents were dead, and he had inherited the house in 17th Street, where his grandfather Ambrose had lived in a setting of black walnut and pier glasses, giving Madeira dinners, and saying to his guests, as they rejoined the ladies across a florid waste of Aubusson carpet, "This, sir, is Dabney's first study for the Niagara. The Grecian slave in the bay window was executed for me in Rome 20 years ago by my old friend Ezra Stimson, by token, of which he passed for a Maecenas in the New York of the 40s, apostrophe and a poem had once been published in the Keepsake or the Book of Beauty on a picture in the possession of Jonathan Ambrose, Esquire. Since then the house had remained unchanged. Paul's father, a frugal liver and hard-headed manipulator of investments, did not inherit old Jonathan's artistic sensibilities, and was content to live and die in the unmodified black walnut and red rep of his predecessor. It was only in Paul that the grandfather's aesthetic faculty revived, and Mrs. Ambrose used often to say to her husband, as they watched the little pale-browed boy poring over an old number of the art journal, "All will know how to appreciate your father's treasures." In recognition of these transmitted gifts, Paul, on leaving Harvard, was sent to Paris with a tutor, and established in a studio in which nothing was ever done. He could not paint, and recognized the fact early enough to save himself much wasted labor, and his friends many painful efforts in dissimulation. But he brought back a touching enthusiasm for the forms of beauty which an old civilization had revealed to him, and an apostolic ardor in the cause of their dissemination. He had paused in his harangue to take in my ill-timed parenthesis, and the color mounted slowly to his thin cheekbones. "It is an ugly room," he owned, as though he had noticed the library for the first time. The desk was carved at the angles with the heads of helmeted knights with long black walnut mustaches. The red cloth top was worn threadbare, and patterned like a map with islands and peninsulas of ink, and in its center throned a massive bronze inkstand representing a Syrian maiden slumbering by a well beneath a palm tree. "The fact is," I said, walking home that evening with Ned Hallidon, "old Paul will never do anything, for the simple reason that he's too stingy." Ned, who was an idealist, shook his handsome head. "It's not that, my dear fellow. He simply doesn't see things when they're too close to him. I'm glad you woke him up to that desk." The next time I dined with Paul, he said, when we entered the library, and I had gently rejected one of his cheap cigars in favor of a superior article of my own, "Look here, I've been looking round for a decent writing table. I don't care, as a rule, to turn out old things, especially when they've done good service, but I see now that this is too monstrous for an apostle of beauty to write his evangel on." I agreed, "It is a little inappropriate, except as an awful warning." Paul colored. "Well, but, my dear fellow, I'd no idea how much a table of this kind costs. I find I can't get anything decent, the plainest mahogany under $150. He hung his head, and pretended not to notice that I was taking out my own cigar. "Well, what's $150 to you?" I rejoined. "You talk as if you had to live on a bookkeeper's salary, with a large family to support." He smiled nervously, and twirled the ring on his thin finger. I know that's all very well. But for 20 tables that I don't buy, I can send some fellow abroad and unseal his eyes." "Oh, hang it, do both," I exclaimed impatiently, "but the writing table was never bought. The library remained as it was, and so did the contention between Aladdin and myself, as to whether this inconsistent acceptance of his surroundings was due, on our friend's part, to a congenital inability to put his hand in his pocket, or to a real unconsciousness of the ugliness that happened to fall inside his point of vision. But he owned that the table was ugly, I agreed. Yes, but not till you'd called his attention to the fact, and I'll wager he became unconscious of it again, as soon as your back was turned. Not before he'd had time to look at a lot of others, and make up his mind that he couldn't afford to buy one. That was just his excuse. He'd rather be thought mean than insensible to ugliness. But the truth is that he doesn't mind the table, and is used to it. He knows his way about the drawers. But he could get another with the same number of drawers. Too much trouble, argued Aladdin. Too much money, I persisted. Oh, hang it now, if he were mean would he have founded 3 traveling scholarships, and be planning this big academy of arts? Well, he's mean to himself, at any rate. Yes, and magnificently, royally generous to all the world besides. Aladdin exclaimed with one of his great flushes of enthusiasm. But if, on the whole, the last word remained with Aladdin, and Ambrose's personal chariness seemed a trifling foible compared to his altruistic breadth of intention, yet neither of us could help observing, as time went on, that the habit of thrift was beginning to impede the execution of his schemes of art philanthropy. The 3 traveling scholarships had been founded in the first blaze of his ardor, and before the personal management of his property had awakened in him the sleeping instincts of parsimony. But as his capital accumulated, and problems of investment and considerations of interest began to encroach upon his visionary hours, we saw a gradual arrest in the practical development of his plan. For every $1,000 he talks of spending on his work, I believe he knocks off a cigar, or buys one less newspaper, Aladdin grumbled affectionately. But after all, he went on, with one of the quick revivals of optimism that gave a perpetual freshness to his spirit, after all, it makes one admire him all the more when one sees such a nature condemned to be at war with the petty inherited instinct of greed. Still, I could see it was a disappointment to Aladdin that the great project of the Academy of Arts should languish on paper long after all its details had been discussed and settled to the satisfaction of the projector and of the expert advisors he had called in council. He's quite right to do nothing in a hurry to take advice and compare ideas and points of view, to collect and classify his material in advance. Aladdin argued, in answer to a taunt of mine about Paul's perpetually reiterated plea that he was still waiting for so-and-so's report, but now that the plan's mature and such a plan, you'll grant it's magnificent? I should think he'd burn to see it carried out, instead of pottering over it till his enthusiasm cools, and the whole business turns stale on his hands. That summer Ambrose went to Europe, and spent his holiday in a frugal walking tour through Brittany. When he came back he seemed refreshed by his respite from business cares, and from the interminable revision of his cherished scheme, while contact with the concrete manifestations of beauty had, as usual, renewed his flagging ardor. By Jove, he cried, whenever I indulged my unworthy eyes in a long gaze at one of those big things, picture or church or statue, I kept saying to myself, you lucky devil, you, to be able to provide such a sight as that for eyes that can make some good use of it. Isn't it better to give 50 fellows a chance to paint or carve or build than to be able to daub canvas or punch clay in a corner all by yourself? Well, I said, when he had worked off his first ebullition, when is the foundation stone to be laid? His excitement dropped. The foundation stone, when are you going to touch the electric button that sets the thing going? Paul, with his hands in his sagging pockets, began to pace the library hearthrug. I can see him now, setting his shabby red slippers between its ramified cabbages. My dear fellow, there are one or two points to be considered. Still one or two new suggestions I picked up over there. I sat silent, and he paused before me, flushing to the roots of his thin hair. Why you think I've had time enough that I ought to have put the thing through before this? I suppose you're right. I can see that even Ned Hallinan thinks so, and he has always understood my difficulties better than you have. This insinuation exasperated me. And Ned would have put it through years ago. I broke out. Paul pulled at his straggling mustache. Why you mean he has more executive capacity? More no, it's not that. He's not afraid to spend money, and I am, he suddenly exclaimed. He had never before alluded to this weakness to either of us, and I sat abashed, suffering from his evident distress. But he remained planted before me, his little legs wide apart, his eyes fixed on mine in an agony of voluntary self-exposure. That's my trouble, and I know it. Big sums frighten me, I can't look them in the face. By George, I wish Ned had the carrying out of this scheme. I wish he could spend my money for me. His face was lit by the reflection of a passing thought. Do you know, I shouldn't wonder if I dropped out of the running before either of you chaps, and in case I do, I've half a mind to leave everything in Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.